listening. Have a good week. Take care of yourself and take care of one another.
To KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm. KBOO's board is recruiting directors. In preparation for our annual board election in September, KBOO's nominating committee will be holding virtual information sessions from now through June. KBOO's Board of Directors guides the station's strategic plan and represents the interests and visions of all of our members. BIPOC persons are especially encouraged to apply. More information and meeting times can be found at kboo.fm/boardrecruiting. Thank you for considering board work at KBOO.
KBOO just finished our annual All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign. We want to thank all of our supporters for helping us bring the community engaging, unique, and all-around fun special episodes and killer marathons. We wouldn't be able to do it without our listeners. And if you missed out on any of the programming, you can check out the list of specials at kboo.fm/thrills.
I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your volunteer-powered, member-supported, nonprofit community radio station. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle, and on today's episode, we hear about library workers and books, about lawsuits against big oil, and about local lies about taxes. Remember that you can support KBOO by clicking on the red Donate tab in the KBOO app or in the upper right corner of the website at kboo.fm. KBOO helps us have the information and the community we need in order to combat some of the inequities and thefts that we face. Thefts of rightful recompense for labor, thefts of public resources through privatization and misallocation of funding and tax avoidance, thefts of indigenous children and resources as well as land, thefts of a livable environment by fossil fuel companies, thefts of truth or accurate knowledge by propaganda and misleading and confusing spin. On today's episode of the Old Mole Variety Hour, Joe Clement shares news about the Fort Vancouver Regional Library workers' struggle for a living wage, drawing connections with regional library systems and national library privatization firms. Since 2009, Fort Vancouver Regional Libraries have used funds intended for library workers to instead build, renovate, or begin construction on new libraries. New libraries are great, but where is that money coming from? While library workers are grossly underpaid, library administrators get six-figure salaries. One of the great things about libraries, of course, is that they still have books. You can check them out for free and then bring them back for others to read. Both the Fort Vancouver Regional Libraries and the Multnomah County Library have in their collections the award-winning 2023 novel The Berry Pickers by Indigenous writer Amanda Peters. On today's show, we'll hear a review of that historical mystery by Larry Bolden, read by Patricia Kullberg. The Berry Pickers explores some of the injustices faced by Indigenous peoples, but tribes are also using federal courts to fight back against injustices. The Makah Indian Tribe and Shoalwater Bay Indian Tribe in western Washington have filed suit over their loss of habitable land due to acidification, hotter temperatures, droughts, and other climate damages. In their Left and the Law segment today, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talk about these and other lawsuits, 30 of them, against oil companies underway in cities and states around the U.S., including a case filed by Multnomah County around damages from the 2021 heat wave and fires. Jan and Mike will be discussing legal advances in recent lawsuits against big oil and the significance of these advances for the climate justice movement. Finally today, we'll hear local economist Mary King explaining local taxes, debunking the business lobby talking point that Portland has unusually high taxes. We don't. As she'll explain, Oregon is in the middle of the pack for state and local taxes that businesses pay, while for households, our per-person taxes are among the most equitable in the country, largely because we don't have a sales tax. What's more, the downtown building owners griping loudest about their local tax bills get all kinds of federal, state, and local tax breaks. As ever, you'll be able to find the podcast of the show and its segments on our website at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Where you can also find a link to subscribe to our show and to contact us with suggestions, comments, or questions. And remember, you can support your listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered, unionized, nonprofit community radio station by clicking on the red Donate tab on the KBOO app or snail-mailing your support to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. We go now to Joe Clement, sharing library news.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm going to read an article from the Northwest Labor Press published on March 1st about Fort Vancouver Regional Libraries and their workers' struggle to be paid a living wage. Mallory Grubin reports, every Wednesday, Melanie McCree wakes up at 4:30 a.m. to drive to a friend's house to wash her clothes. She would prefer to do laundry at her own place, but the wiring in her 700-square-foot home was last updated in 1981 and can't safely support a washing machine. Quote, to redo the wiring would cost upwards of $2,000, McCree told the Fort Vancouver Regional Libraries Board during a public meeting on February 20th. Quote, I wanted you all to know that I work for the library for 23 years and I have to wash my clothes at someone else's home. McCree is a member of the Washington Public Employees Association, which represents about 160 library workers at Fort Vancouver Regional Libraries. Excluding managers and the librarians themselves, the union covers workers in practically every job in the libraries. Headquartered in Vancouver, Fort Vancouver Regional Libraries runs 15 libraries and bookmobile services in southwest Washington. Its coverage area includes Clark, Skamania, and Klickitat counties, as well as the city of Woodland. In June 2023, the union started bargaining a new contract with the board. Negotiations have hit a standstill over wages. Quote, things went really well for a while until we started talking about money, said Abby Hart, Washington Public Employees Association rep and a member of the bargaining team. A 2022 wage study by the Washington Secretary of State shows that the Fort Vancouver Regional Library's executive director was the second highest paid library director in the state, making about $172,000 per year. Hart said that since then, the salary for that position has increased by about 10%. In October 2023, the library hired a new director, Jennifer Giltrop, under a contract providing $195,000. Meanwhile, Washington Public Employees Association members were among the lowest paid, if not dead last, for their positions, the study shows. The starting wage for some positions, like library assistants, now equals the state's $16.28 an hour minimum wage. This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. As an editorial aside, the board chair, Christy Morgan, disputes that the executive director, Jennifer Giltrop, is the second highest paid in the state. At the latest board meeting on Monday, she claimed that King County, Snow Isle, and interestingly, Multnomah County libraries, despite not being in Washington, as well as Seattle, all pay their executive directors more. This is a difference that does not really make a difference. It doesn't change anything about the relationship between the lowest paid workers of Fort Vancouver Regional Libraries and their executive director. Later, we'll hear an interesting response from lead negotiator Abby Hart. But now, back to Mallory Grubin's article. On February 20th, more than three dozen library workers in blue WPEA shirts flooded the board meeting to share their personal stories about why they need a pay raise in the next contract. They made up the vast majority of the 50-person audience. This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I've been reading an article from the Northwest Labor Press by Mallory Grubin about the low-paid library workers of Fort Vancouver Regional Libraries and their struggle for a living wage in their next contract they've been bargaining since last summer. Now, I was able to get audio from Monday's board meeting, but I didn't have enough time to do a whole lot with it, so I wanted to pull three of the comments that WPEA members and organizers made during the meeting.
My name is Abby Hart, she, her pronouns, and I'm the lead negotiator for the awesome WPEA members here at the library. Since the last board meeting, we've had two bargaining sessions for WPEA and the library to negotiate a new CBA. While management may feel that it is not fiscally responsible to review the operating budget and carve out more funding to invest in staff wages, the frontline staff know that is not true. The frontline staff have seen FVRL invest millions of dollars into new buildings and into wages for the administration team at this library. Speaking frankly, I've negotiated about 20 different union contracts in my career so far, including contracts for four other public libraries in Washington State. I understand how difficult funding for local libraries can be, given initiatives in our state that severely limit how much money the library can ask for taxpayers to invest in their local library. I have a lot of sympathy for that predicament when bargaining around library budgets. But here's what I want you to know. Of all five libraries where I've represented workers and negotiated their contracts, I have not seen the significant wage gap between the administration team and the lowest paid frontline worker that I see at FVRL. I have also not encountered a compensation plan, which is as complicated and convoluted as that which FVRL uses to pay WPEA employees. I also want to respond to the chair's opening comments in our meeting today. I'm honestly so heartened to hear the board compare wages for their staff to the wages at Multnomah County Library System, because my understanding is that management has not been willing to compare union staff salaries to the sibling library, and this feels like a step in the right direction. Regarding Seattle Public's ED's salary, I am also heartened to hear that FVRL feels this library is a comparable library for understanding the market value of wages. Since Seattle is not typically considered comparable to a regional library system like this one, as a municipal library system, SPL has access to funding through the city, which provides a significant buffer for budget management. WPEA looks forward to bringing both of these comparables forward in wage discussions in the future. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Narissa Eckerson. I've worked with FVR Libraries and served as a shop steward for our union WPEA for 6 years. At last month's board meeting, you heard from many staff and community members demanding a living wage for our library workers. I imagine that may have been overwhelming and at times felt like a personal attack. Through no fault of your own, you've inherited a decades-long problem that needs amending. You're all in a position of great opportunity to do the staff of this library district a good turn and catch up from years of sliding further into poverty with a wage stagnation here at FVR Libraries. We are proud of the work we do serving this community. We want to be proud of how our employer compensates us for our service. It's not lost on our staff that the library's personnel budget is often underspent and moved into reserves, which is spent on many things, including new libraries. I'm presenting you with over 600 signatures from our community at large in support of these public servants making a living wage. One of the signees says, paying all your staff enough to live on is the right thing to do. It's also the smart thing to do. Your staff are worth more than any equipment or resource. They are what makes a library a library. We need you, the Board of Trustees, to work with the Executive Director and review the operating budget so we can find a way to invest more public funding into our staff. Thank you.
Greetings, honorable members and our executive director. I'm Daria Ruggles. Appreciate you hearing me tonight. I have a proclamation here for you. It's honoring library workers. It was signed by Mayor Ann and Vancouver City Council. Our elected officials and greater community publicly acknowledge the value of our library workers. For 30 years, I have engaged with FVRL. I volunteered for door drops for levy lifts, registered voters, attended groundbreakings, helped name our VA book nook, and I am currently a member of our Friends. During my 13 years employed at FVRL, we had three market studies costing tens of thousands of dollars each, the promise to get the data needed to finally pay a fair wage, but every time resulted in the lowest paid workers remaining, shamefully so. A year and a half of bargaining and I got 37 cents. My ending wage, $17 an hour. Do you need a market study to tell you that this is not a fair living wage? But FVRL insists they do not pay a living wage, but what the market dictates. FVRL is not a corporation, even as it reflects the disparity and inequity between the lowest paid and admin that some corporations do. So if markets decree that people living in desperate times desperately need a job, FVRL takes advantage. I witnessed a major brain drain of so many talented, dedicated staff. Yet somehow the budget always allows for the highest paid to continue their climb. As a taxpayer, I vote and pay for what makes our community stronger. I am child-free, but always say yes to schools because schools and libraries strengthen our communities for all of us. Honor FVRL workers as community taxpayers and elected officials do. Work with your executive director, your HR, and your budget to make this happen. Give library workers the dignity of a fair living wage. It's time. FVRL is overdue.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We were just hearing public testimony at this Monday's Fort Vancouver Regional Library's board meeting by members of Washington Public Employees Association and some of their union reps. I'm going to keep tabs on this story next month. National Library Workers Day and Week are in early mid-April, when national attention will be focused on libraries and the workers that steward their collections and serve their patrons. For one thing, the new director, Jennifer Giltrop, was the former chief library officer for Library Systems and Services, a library privatization firm. They buy up often distressed public library systems. They restructure them like a private equity firm and often lay workers off, try to bust the union, degrade work conditions and cut collections and service and just get the most bang for their buck. They privatize public library systems and together are the third largest library system in the country. Both Truthout and Literary Hub did excellent exposés of library privatization in the last few years. Literary Hub quoted the founder of Library Systems and Services, Frank Pizanite, as saying this: in his view, a lot of libraries are atrocious. For this, he blames not underfunding, but the librarians themselves. Quote, their policies are all about job security, he told a reporter. Quote, you can go to a library for 35 years and never have to do anything, and then have your retirement, end quote. Pizanite seems to have made it his mission in life to whip these lazy librarians into shape. When his company takes over a library, the librarians who work there, the ones who aren't laid off outright, become his employees, and he has a message for them. Quote, we're not running our company that way. You come to us, you're going to have to work. Now, Giltrop doesn't work for Library Systems and Services anymore, but somebody who becomes an officer in a company like that, getting involved with public libraries, is a little concerning. And it should be concerning for those of us who live in Multnomah County, because the library director here, Vailey Oakley, is retiring after 15 years of being the director and overseeing the modernization of Multnomah County libraries, which deep down in the 2020 bond and the rationales for the expansion of the libraries has been portrayed as a struggle between operational costs and tax revenue limits. In practice, it has been a struggle against operational costs only, which is to say labor. They love to tell us that it is our greatest expense. This has led to two scathing county auditors' reports in the last few years of the pandemic, as well as a class action lawsuit citing racial discrimination filed by Black former staff. Will someone like Giltrop replace Multnomah County Library's director, who makes over $200,000 a year? I want to draw attention to the library systems in the region, which are bound together by a reciprocal agreement that means that patrons in different areas of the several counties around Portland get to use the library services of all the other libraries in those areas. As libraries in the greater metropolitan area, we have shared work conditions, whether as the front lines of the class war, where we have poor, mentally ill, or houseless people who are rejected by society and struggle with addiction and the traumas of living outside and abused by the police and other people who come to the library as the heart of a heartless world. Or a culture war where libraries are attacked for being sites of degeneracy and playfields of pedophilia and DEI and wokeness corrupting children. But then we also share economic conditions, as libraries are all too often failing to pay a living wage, let alone a wage that compensates us for the world-holding physical, cognitive, social, emotional labor that we perform. That said, you can take action today by signing the FVRL Workers Petition through a link we'll share when this is posted today. You can email the Board of Trustees at trustees@fvrl.org, and you can attend board meetings through the website www.fvrl.org/board-trustees. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Joe Clement. I've been reporting on the struggle for living wages at Fort Vancouver Regional Libraries and discussing their issues in connection to other libraries in the area and beyond.
You're trying to tell me capital has won at last. Anyone who's not convinced has just been shown the door. You're trying to tell me competition turns the wheels, smart money never deals in welfare anymore. Survival of the fittest keeps the species strong. Change is always painful, but it doesn't last too long. Excuse me, friend, I think you could be wrong. When some of us are free to rise and some are free to fall, all of us are under the dictatorship of capital.
That was Alistair Hewlett singing The Dictatorship of Capital. And before that, Joe Clement sharing news of the Fort Vancouver Regional Libraries and the direction of libraries regionally and beyond. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. You can check the KBOO webpage for today's show to find more information about all of our segments, including links to ways to support library workers. While you're there, you can click on the red Donate tab to support KBOO, one of the more egalitarian institutions you'll find anywhere. Later on today's show, we'll hear Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker with a Left and the Law segment about taking big oil to court and holding them responsible for their deceptions about climate change. And we'll hear from economist Mary King debunking the myth that Portland has unusually high taxes. And you can visit your local library to find a copy of The Berry Pickers, reviewed next by Larry Bolden, in a review read by Patricia Kullberg.
Good morning. This is Patricia Kullberg with another book recommendation from our book mole, Larry Bolden. In this review, he briefly discusses the novel The Berry Pickers by Indigenous writer Amanda Peters. It's a story of tragedy, loss, and mystery told by two narrators, Joe, a Mi'kmaq boy who believes himself to be bad luck to his family, and Norma, a girl whose own young life is shrouded in secrets. It's a story that resonates with the long and shameful history of Indigenous children being wrested by force from their families in a campaign to erase Native American culture and history. Here's Larry's take on the novel, The Berry Pickers. A 4-year-old Mi'kmaq girl who, with her family, has arrived in Maine from Nova Scotia, disappears from the blueberry fields. She is last seen by her brother, Joe, who is 6. It's 1962, and the family, who has come on its annual trek to pick berries and apples, is distraught when she vanishes and searches for any signs of her for years after her disappearance. So begins this wonderfully wrought story of grief and loss and family love. The Berry Pickers by Amanda Peters, part historical novel and part mystery, is such a lovely book. Quote, "The day Ruthie went missing, the black flies seemed to be especially hungry. The white folks at the store where we got our supplies said that Indians made such good berry pickers because something sour in our blood kept the black flies away. But even then, as a boy of 6, I knew that wasn't true. Black flies don't discriminate." End quote. Joe is one of the narrators of the story, and Norma is the other. Norma is different from the other members of her large family and often asks her parents why she is so much darker than others in the family. Along with Ruthie's disappearance, this is the second mystery that slowly unravels as the novel spools out. The parents tell Norma that her great-grandfather was Italian and that she has his skin tone, which comes out in the sun. The true story is quite different, but I don't give away mysteries. Amanda Peters is herself a writer of Mi'kmaq and settler ancestry, and it shows in the careful research she displays in her novel. Joe is hit by a truck, resulting in horrible injuries that leave him an invalid. Quote, "I opened my eyes to unfamiliar faces switching this tube for that tube, pressing buttons and taking my temperature. I don't even remember having that many hands on me all at the same time, and I didn't like it. I tried to move away, but my body wouldn't oblige. I tried to find my father, but one of my eyes seemed to have shrunk. I found out the next day that I'd broken the eye socket, and the eye was nearly swollen shut. I also learned that I had a skull fracture from where my head bounced off the asphalt, a broken pelvis from the impact, a broken wrist, 10 broken ribs out of 12 on my left side, a punctured lung, and possibly a spinal injury, which the doctors could only examine after the swelling went down." End quote. Since I have no intention of giving away any of the mysteries in this suspenseful novel, there is little more I can say about it. It is wonderfully researched, wonderfully written, and for me, a novel take on racism. I will say that this is the second book this year I have chosen partly for the cover. The other was Pomegranate. Both books have such beautiful and artful covers. I hope the brevity of this review does not give the book short shrift. I have been talking about Amanda Peters' 2023 novel, The Berry Pickers. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I'm Patricia Kullberg, reading today for Larry. Costa, I think it's gonna be your time.
your time. We got a whole lot of Indians clustered on a line. We got warriors to the left, warriors to the right. A whole sacred nation is ready for a fight. Custer, I think it's gonna be your time. We got a whole lot of Indians and Custer on a line.
That was the Blue Mountain Tribe singing Custer. And before that, Patricia Kullberg reading Larry Bolden's review of The Berry Pickers by Amanda Peters. I'm Fran Michel, and you are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Indigenous peoples have responded to the trauma inflicted on them not only with art, like Peter's novel and the Blue Mountain Tribe's music, but also, of course, with political action. Indigenous activists have led the way in the fight for a livable climate, but they're not fighting alone. The harms that frontline groups have been suffering first and worst are coming for us all. Climate activists and attorneys are working around the world and around the country to hold fossil fuel corporations responsible for the deceptions they've practiced and the damage they're doing. Later on today's show, we'll hear from economist Mary King undoing some of the deceptions that business lobbyists have promoted about taxation in Portland, which, contrary to what you might have heard, is not unusually high. But next up, we hear from the left and the law, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker discussing some of the many lawsuits underway against oil corporations in cities and states around the U.S.
Well, Mike, the arc of justice seems to bend very slowly in cases brought against big oil. For years now, we have followed lawsuits in municipalities around the country, totaling around 30 by now. You have explained why these cases are so agonizingly slow as they move through the courts, even with mounting evidence of the oil company's crimes of deception. And as the climate crisis escalates, so do the obscene profits of oil and gas companies. They seem to even have backed off from their pretend concern about the climate crisis. So, Mike, let's start by talking about the gains in cases around the country, including the case filed here in Multnomah County in 2023. Can you give us a lay of the land?
Okay, well, the lay of the land is looking a lot better than it was a year ago, mainly because finally the U.S. Supreme Court has put an end to the chief stalling tactic of the oil companies, which is to try to federalize these state lawsuits. And we talked about the Minnesota lawsuit that Keith Ellison brought. He brought it in 20, and it has finally been allowed to go ahead by the U.S. Supreme Court's refusal to mess with the decision by the federal court, recognizing that, yeah, the states have their own right to do this. There is no right to jerk the case out of a state court and force it into a federal court.
Can you just explain a bit about why that's been so crucial, the distinction between taking cases to the federal court and the oil company's argument that this is a federal issue, congressional issue, rather than an issue for state or local municipalities?
Well, Jan, it's not really an important issue in this context. It's just a stall tactic. It's a way to delay deciding the merits of the case. It's no more, no less than that. It's not a very interesting argument. It's one that can matter a lot in certain contexts, but not in this one. It's strictly a delay. And now Minnesota's allowed to go ahead. You know, these cases have their own timeline, and they are moving, finally, really, truly moving. And they've hit a certain critical mass where they're expanding. But I'll get into how far they've reached after talking about one of the most interesting, which is filed right here in Portland. It's a Multnomah County lawsuit. It's the first one of its kind that seeks to hold a major oil and gas companies accountable for decades of client deception in terms of a specific event, namely the deadly 2021 heat dome that squatted over Oregon and Portland in June of 2021. So the lawsuit, it's a very interesting claim. It's got a new way of attributing blame to fossil fuel companies. The defendants are Exxon, BP, Conoco, Koch Industries, Total, as well as industry trade groups like the Petroleum Association. And the lawsuit says that the heat dome, which killed 69 people in Multnomah County, put a huge strain on municipal resources and was, quote, virtually impossible without human-caused climate change.
Can I add something of the wording from that complaint?
Well, sure.
They charge a scheme to rapaciously sell fossil fuel products and deceptively promote them as harmless to the environment, while they knew that carbon pollution emitted by their products in the atmosphere would likely cause deadly extreme heat events and so on. So the language is clearly dramatic and is framed in a morally charged way. Some complaints and briefs have very dry legal language. This is not that. Does that make a difference?
Well, it's a tactic, but they also, I think, are trying to counteract the fact that they rely heavily on abstract mathematical principles, the attribution theories. They're reaching to mean to attribute this damage to the oil companies and to fossil fuel use. But those are all peripheral. The heart of this case, as well as all the other cases, is what was the heart of the tobacco industry cases, namely the discovery about 8 or 9 years ago of memoranda and documents turned over by the oil companies concerning their knowledge of what was happening. The fact that they've been taking strides in terms of capital allocation based on climate change. At the same time, they're funding institutions that deny it or more frequently try to cast doubt on it, saying it's up in the air. There are some say yes and others no. It's a debatable point.
Why is the deception, and for some it involves a case of conspiracy, why is this so central to these cases?
It shows your frame of mind. It shows, which is very difficult to prove, somebody's intent. This proves their intent, namely that they spread documents and arguments to the effect that climate change was not real or that climate change was debatable, knowing all the time that it was a reality. It was so real that they located refineries and made other huge investments based on its existence. So that intent is always a critical element, like of a crime. If you kill somebody, that's not going to be murder. If, you know, there's all sorts of, it could be self-defense, it could be an explosive rage. But if you have the frame of mind of deliberate and premeditation, then you've got a first-degree murder. So criminal intent is always important, and intent is important in civil cases as well.
Now, let's talk some about the California cases that were significant not only in their size and the number of municipalities, but this, as I understand it, is the only fossil fuel producing state that has gone after big oil. It's much harder in states where oil is a central part of the machinery of the economy.
Exactly. The California case was enormous in every way because California is enormous. It has enough money to deal with whatever the oil companies throw at them. They've got essentially limitless resources, and they are also now consolidated with all the other lawsuits brought by counties and cities in California. As of 3 weeks ago, both the plaintiffs and defendants agreed to consolidate. So there'll be one big lawsuit that will be truly a big lawsuit. It will be well covered, and it will not happen soon because they're proceeding now with discovery, where California will be allowed to seek documents from and sworn testimony from big oil officials. They'll be able to target particular individuals. And it will be heavily influenced by contemporary events when the trials start, as is the criminal trial. If there's been a recent horrible crime, then you're in worse shape than if things have been relatively calm. And you're right about how they've retreated from promises made under some heat 3 or 4 years ago. But since the outbreak of the war in Ukraine, the price of oil spiking, oil companies have been rolling in money, hundreds of billions of dollars in profits. And they want to keep that rolling, and they have in turn taken back, without nearly the same publicity that they started, any and all promises to shift to cleaner forms of energy.
They have objected to the municipality where the case will be tried or centrally tried in San Francisco. And the claim is that San Francisco has so much anti-fossil fuel sentiment that they won't be fair there. And of course, the judges assure their attorneys that they will be unbiased and fair in approaching the trial, which always seems kind of funny. But how important has that loss been? Apparently, they lost their appeal to take the case away from the San Francisco court.
Of course, venue is very important. If it were tried in Kern County, which has a huge amount of oil producers in that county, they might have a different result. That's why it would be really a coup for people suing big oil to sue them in like Pennsylvania or Ohio or Texas or states where fossil fuel is an active industry with lots of employees. You know, the places that have brought it have been the usual blue states, Massachusetts, New York, New England, Oregon, California. California is the first state that actually has, in part, a oil-producing section, but California is just a monster state. It's got elements of every single part of our economy there. It would be really better in many ways to have a case initiated in Ohio or Pennsylvania, I think. But these cases are cresting. They're coming together. They're proliferating. Chicago just brought a similar lawsuit alleging climate fraud. And these cases, we need to distinguish them from the Montana case, for example, that we talked about last August, where a judge in Montana found a constitutional right to a clean and healthy environment. That's a novel finding. But these cases are very orthodox state court fraud and damages suits. They point to fraud committed by the oil companies, and they point to damages. Now, the defense by oil companies is two-part. One is, this is such a huge problem that can only be dealt with by Congress and on a national or international level, at a level of governance which actually does not exist right now. Secondly, that we're doing something critical and essential that you rely on every day. So in order to get around those defenses, that's why the element of intent is critical. It shows that they have, in order to proliferate the use, and there's all sorts of discretionary calls that made by everybody at an individual level and regions as well about how they're going to allocate funds for transportation. And those decisions are affected by the cost of oil, by the information available about burning oil. And so there have been some fairly adept and fairly specific efforts to work out precisely what damages have been caused by each of these companies, the size of each of these companies, and the defendants, and demonstrations that there have been damage that would have been impossible without human-caused climate change, and human-caused climate change is supported, it's advanced, it's defended by these oil companies.
I'd like to note as well a recent important case here in the Pacific Northwest. The Macaw Indian Tribe and Shoalwater Bay Indian Tribe are suing oil companies for millions of dollars in cost to move their communities because of rising seas from the Olympic Peninsula region, areas where they've lived and depended on the land and the water for millennia for their way of life. And, you know, the tribes have been very important in advancing legal strategies around the violation of treaty rights, their access to areas that sustain traditional ways of living. Is that case significantly different in your understanding from cases that are being advanced through these states and cities around the country?
Well, it is different. For one, it has been moved to federal court, and it will proceed there. But tribal cases are traditionally brought in federal court rather than in any particular state. And it's a very good case. And I think the sign of a successful litigious environment is that there are variations. Each of these cases is different. Some of them seek on a basis of fraud. Some of them are seeking damages, but they have different theories of liability. They have different evidence that they will be seeking from the oil companies, and they do support each other. When you hit a critical mass of these cases going forward, you know, it's a steady increase in the costs imposed to defend by the oil companies. And these damages are not trivial.
In terms of just paying off, which has been a strategy of corporations forever, is just paying the fine and moving on.
Yeah. Well, the Multnomah County one seeks more than $51 billion in damages and in efforts to make reparations for the damage caused by the heat dome. And, you know, $50 billion here, $50 billion there, and pretty soon you're talking about real money.
There's some that use racketeering as a strategy, and of course, we're most familiar with that strategy recently with Fannie Willis, and of course, the really problematic use of that with the Cop City activist there in Georgia and her using her racketeering charges. So even though people praise her around going after the Trump team on a racketeering strategy, that's also been a real problematic legal strategy. Can you say anything in closing about the racketeering strategy in some of these cases?
It can be a fruitful strategy. It's been, I think, just the language itself is helpful. It is a racket in the sense that Smedley Butler, the Marine from the 20s and the 30s, who routinely invaded Central American companies, said war is a racket. It's basically criminal. These people are very routinely deceptive. And we are not, the criminal law is now designed to primarily be aimed at individuals, primarily people of color. But there are statutes available that will perhaps come into play once these civil suits start playing. And I think, again, that using the RICO Act, along with using the tribal rights, using the various forms of complaints for damages as defined in different states and different cities, all of these are good. All are necessary, really, if we seriously want to make litigation an important tool, one part of a larger effort to stop the climate damage being imposed by fossil fuel.
All of which depends on people on the streets as well as in those courtrooms and demands for an alternative vision of a sane and rational energy policy.
Well, that's true. You cannot expect to sit back and watch litigators change everything any more than you can when you're taking care of your health, just sit around hoping that somebody will come up with a nice pill. I mean, you've got to take charge. You've got to be active.
And also think broadly about what health means and what sustains a healthy society. Conservation was a very big part of the early environmental movement and doesn't have the same sex appeal as new technology schemes that are promoted every day to keep consumer culture and commodity capitalism going at its ferocious, aggressive pace. So, but you're saying these lawsuits are important and bring center stage the villainy of this industry and how it's promoted its own interests at the expense of the survival of people on the planet.
Yeah, and litigation has been a very peripheral, very marginal in that effort. But I think it's coming into its own over the next year or two. I expect 25, particularly 2026, there will be lots of litigation going on in the news all over the country.
And we will follow those cases. Thanks, Mike. We'll stay tuned.
Tell you about the climate dance, it's easy to do. You're nervous and you jump because this world's nearly through. So down some more tea, watch some foreign TV. Put your mind on anything but the truth. A leader's got a climate dance, it's easy to do. You grab hold of the treaty, then you tear it in two. And go back to your people and spin me all about how I think gonna come to no harm. Without a cut, our emissions by 95%.
That was Keshko with Climate Dance. And before that, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker with a Left and the Law segment about lawsuits against oil companies gathering momentum in states and cities around the U.S. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michel. For our last segment today, we hear from economist Mary King. This is a revised version of a column originally published in the award-winning weekly newspaper Street Roots, and we thank the Street Roots team for allowing us to share this version. You can also hear from Street Roots reporters on KBOO's News in Depth every Wednesday evening between 5:30 and 6 p.m. Mary King writes for the Street Smart Economics opinion column in Street Roots. A version of this piece appeared in January. Portland does not have the highest taxes in the country. Here's Mary King.
Don't believe the hype. We do not have the highest taxes in the country. The local press is again spreading a deceptive business lobbyist talking point, claiming that taxes in the Portland metro area are the highest in the country. It's just not true. Total state and local taxes in Oregon, reported by the U.S. Census Bureau, are right in line with several other states, including Washington, Wyoming, and New Mexico. Taxes per person are just three-quarters of New York's and four-fifths of California's. Unlike most states and many cities, we have no sales tax, which holds down our total tax bill and spreads it more fairly. Since the 1990s, our property taxes are limited and increasingly uneven. Many property owners pay tax on assessments far below the market value of their real estate. Oregon's gas taxes are relatively low, too, as are taxes on beer and wine. Only one tax rate on one kind of tax on people with the very highest incomes is relatively high in the Portland area, though lower than in New York City and not much higher than San Francisco. That's the income tax rate paid by very affluent families, combining state, metro, and Multnomah County income taxes. And that combined rate only applies to income that's over $400,000 a year. Half the families in Multnomah County don't have even one-fifth of that much income. What's more, the loudest griping about our local taxes comes from big downtown property owners who get lots of state and local tax breaks on top of coddling by the federal government. They need to recognize what the rest of us see: tremendous value being added to our community and economy through the provision of affordable housing, support for people on the streets, universal preschool, and investments in climate resilience. Oregon is actually a leader in equitable taxation. State and local taxes generally make inequality worse, taking a much bigger chunk from families with the lowest incomes than the highest. We're better than 41 other states, but could be better still. Oregon still takes more from families with a little than people with a lot. Most states are much worse because they rely on sales taxes rather than income taxes. Sales taxes hit people hardest who are just scraping by, spending their entire incomes on necessities. The less money you have, the more of it you'll pay in sales tax. Sales taxes are really high in the South, as well as in Washington, California, and New York. In California, the state sales tax is 7.75%. With local sales tax added to the state one, it's up to 10.75% in some cities. Plus, California car buyers pay those sales taxes when buying a vehicle, even a used car sold by an individual. Compare that to Oregon's vehicle tax of 0.5% charged to car dealers. No sales tax means lower business taxes, too. Oregon is actually in the middle of the pack for combined state and local taxes on businesses. Business tax payments are also held down because we have no retail sales tax. We think of a sales tax as falling on consumers, but businesses also pay it on supplies. To accurately compare business taxes in different states, you need the effective tax rate of all state and local taxes combined. The effective tax rate is how much of total profits companies are paying after working all the tax breaks and accounting tricks available. Effective business tax rates for different states are calculated by business consultants Ernst & Young. We need to look at their two most recent reports because tax payments were shifted between years due to COVID. They find that Oregon's effective business tax rate averaged less than 5% of profits. That puts Oregon near the middle of other states, which ranged from 3.3% to 8.7%. Oregon's commercial activities tax may not make up for the drop in corporate taxes since the 1970s. Since the property tax has been restricted for 30 years, Oregon hugely relies on income taxes to fund the state's spending on education, public safety, and health and human services. But by 2018, the corporate share of income taxes had sunk to less than half what it was in the 1970s, leaving households to foot the bill. In 2019, the Oregon State Legislature passed the corporate activities tax to create the appearance that businesses were once again contributing as they used to. However, the tax design makes it easy to pass the cost on to consumers in higher prices. As the Tax Advisor publication wrote, while the cost of the tax will not be directly borne by the buyer, the same as a sales tax, it is anticipated that some or all of the burden of the tax will be passed on by the seller to the buyer indirectly through higher prices. Federal taxes are low, especially for real estate investors and developers. For decades through the middle of the 20th century, the top federal personal income tax rate fluctuated between 70 and 94% during years of high economic growth. That top rate was brought down by Reagan, Bush II, and Trump. It's been below 40% since 1986. Democrats raise it a little, Republicans bring it back down, most recently Trump in 2017. The Brookings Institution assessed the Trump's tax package, saying it will take resources from future generations and from today's lower and middle-income households to enrich today's well-to-do. Trump's tax cut, half accurately called the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, especially benefited real estate investors and developers. The American Bar Association's analysis of its details concluded the intention was to uplift the real estate business, not the individual homeowner. We have plenty of state and local breaks for real estate investors, too. Oregon tax code generally mirrors the federal. That means the state also gives several big tax breaks to real estate investors and developers, including the members of multimillionaire Jordan Schnitzer's Revitalize Portland Coalition. Schnitzer's group bills itself as the voice of Portland's commercial real estate, focused on providing feedback and advising public officials, meaning lobbying. It's Schnitzer's group leading the charge against the small local income taxes strongly supported by the voters to create universal preschool and provide essential services to people living on the streets. What we never hear mentioned by the real estate industry or the local press is how much of the recent increase in local income taxes was outweighed by federal, state, and local tax cuts and tax breaks. Nor do we hear about the big, widely spread and proven benefits to the local economy of the services being funded by small local income taxes. Thank you.
That was Tax the Rich from The Craze. And before that, economist Mary King explaining that Portland's supposedly high taxes are a beloved talking point of those who seek to gut services, but the numbers tell a different story. You have been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Fran Michelle, and I've been your host for today's show. As always, you'll be able to find the whole show and its individual segments with additional links and information at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Where you can listen again, subscribe, share, and join KBOO by clicking on the red Donate tab in the upper right corner of the page. Thanks very much to the contributors to today's show. Thanks to Joe Clement for playing our theme song and for his report on the struggles of Fort Vancouver Regional Library workers and on libraries around the region and around the nation. Thanks to BookMole Larry Bolden for his review of The Berry Pickers by Amanda Peters and to Patricia Kullberg for her reading and recording of the review. Thanks to Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker for their Left and the Law segment on the growing momentum of litigation against oil companies. Thanks to Mary King for her debunking of the myth that Portlanders pay unusually high taxes. And thanks to Street Roots, where a version of that piece was first published. Thanks to all the staff, volunteers, and listener members of KBOO. The Old Mole will be back next Monday with more news, views, reviews, and interviews. We go out with Mavis Staples singing Fight.
Out on the the streets of Mary's Dolly old room. Can't get me out unless you use a shoehorn. Eve of destruction, but you still talking free trade. You give me lemons and I make lemonade.
So I pray. You earn a penny each one you save. Easy to save it when you don't need a dang thing. Talking about Jesus, but you treat people dead or wrong. Looking for answers, but you singing the same song. Your economics, well, they sure need a change. You know damn well them CEOs need no raise. Freedom and justice, well, they ain't your plaything. Prop up your puppets and you kill the real kings.
So I pray, I'm tired,
so tired.
This can't wait.
Why?
So will we fight?
The way home, I'm in no hurry, go on, push it right on. Yeah, I'm a soldier, but I don't use a gun. Out on the road, but no, my daddy kept one. They say you earn a penny each one you save. Won't mean nothing when you're down in the grave. You know the ends don't really justify means. Pop up your puppets and defile the real queen.
KBOO, Portland, Oregon, bridging the gap between prisons, prisoners, and the community. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Tune in every second and fourth Saturday night, midnight.